Everybody, I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see under the surface.
Right. And today we have a mountain of reality.
Oh, brother, do we.
Good story. This is episode number 47. And Today we're going to talk about Bleak House by Charles Dickens.
Yes, and you said you've never read any Dickens before?
No, I've read one of my favorite stories of all time is A Christmas Story.
Oh.
And I read it probably once every other year. I have a version read by Patrick Stewart that's kind of a bridge that I listen to almost every year.
Oh, I've got to look for that. Maybe you've told me this and I've said it that way before, but baby.
Oh, he's way good. And that is the extent of my Dickens experience, other than Star Trek II, which is a Charles Dickens experience, right?
I'm trying to...
Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan. You said it was a Tale of Two Cities. Yeah. We talked about that in that podcast. But,
right.
So that has just moved up my list because, you know, after that podcast, I said, yeah, I'm going to read A Tale of Two Cities. But, you know, when you're presented with a Dickens novel and they're huge, you look at that and go, I think I'll read something else first.
Oh, yeah.
But then, you know, you gave me Bleak House to read, and there was no getting around that, right?
No, and
it blew me away.
I felt bad because it's so long.
No, but it blew me away. I feel inadequate to even talk about it for an hour.
Yeah, and that's what was happening to me, too. I sat down and said, wow. I started looking through it because I probably got literally 30 markers in here. And so I start looking through them, and I'm thinking, there's no way to really sum it up very easily. But at the same time, I'm dipping into it thinking, I want to reread it.
Yeah.
Because I finished it about a month ago. So, so good. And a lot of people, from what I've read, say this is his masterpiece, his best book.
Well, I believe it. I can't imagine better than this. And it blows me away because... You know, you told me this, and I looked it up to find out exactly how it was done, but Bleak House was published in monthly installments. Mm-hmm. I think it was 19 monthly installments. It was 20, really, but the last one I read came out, they published two at the same time in one booklet, the last one.
It was a double edition.
So it was a double edition. So,
it was 32 pages a month.
Writing it that way,
all that time.
In a serial way, you know. And what's funny is Stephen King, you know, after he must get bored with writing. But remember when he did The Green Mile? I don't know if you recall when he wrote.
I know of The Green Mile.
Yeah, when he wrote The Green Mile, he did it in serial form.
Oh, really?
Yeah, about 70 or 80 pages at a time in a little thin paperback. And he said, "Well, I'm going to try this like Charles Dickens did it." So I think he was just playing around. Yeah. So you can still find those little paperbacks, not new, but you could look on eBay or whatever and buy them. I think there were 6 or 7 of them.
Well, and of course for Dickens, it was a matter of making a living. He was so popular, and I had a lot of stuff printed out about Bleak House that I was going to read tonight, and I left it at work. So I'm very ill prepared on background on him, but he was such an interesting guy because he was kind of willing to try anything. He was one of these people who he'd travel around the country and even to America doing public readings of his work for people to show up at. He would do it in tandem with other people who he liked, other authors. They'd have like a night of readings by all these people. So he was a showman. He loved, you know, that grandiose way of acting it out also. And then he would do this in serial form. At one point he had his own magazine and he would publish his works in there, but also other people's too.
Wow.
And then after one of these would come out in serial form, they'd go back, of course, and do it as a book. And that's when he could go back and fix stuff that hadn't quite worked out, or there was a big plot hole or something that came up because he was writing it serially.
Well, that's interesting. I looked up kind of who his contemporaries were because I was curious, and I kind of wrote a few of them down. So this book was written in it was completed in 1853. And okay. Uncle Tom's Cabin was 1852.
Oh.
By Harriet Beecher Stowe, which you read on Forgotten Classics.
Yes. And he actually met her. And what was it that he said? He really loved her, but he was and really respected the book, but he wasn't crazy about the book or something like that.
Interesting.
I got to read a story of his life sometime. I think G.K. Chesterton wrote one.
Oh, that'd did he really? Oh, I'd read that. Yeah. I wouldn't read a big 600 pager, but I would read a 150 pager.
Yeah, I think it's one of G.K.'s shorter ones.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So yeah.
Moby Dick was written in 1851. So Melville was running around at the time.
And so that means that Hawthorne was also around because he and Melville he was older than Melville, but they were kind of buddies for a while.
Yeah, The Scarlet Letter, 1850.
Okay.
And then Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte was 1847. So she's running around at the same time. And then I didn't write anything down from 1853 to 1868, but in 1868, Little Women was published by Louisa May Alcott.
Which I love.
That's another book I know very well because directed a play.
Oh,
that my daughter was in. That was fun.
Right.
Yeah, a long time ago.
I remember.
Yeah.
Or you talked about it or something. Yeah.
A Christmas Carol was published in 1843. Mm-hmm. And Edgar Allan Poe's A Cask of Amontillado was 1846. So
this was like a golden decade or something.
Yeah, it's just interesting to see who's around at the same time. I found that cool.
And then, if Uncle Tom's Cabin, because I was going to say, wasn't the Civil War the early 1850s?
I'm listing American and British both, sorry to interrupt there, but what'd you say?
No. I was thinking the Civil War was the 1850s, right?
Wasn't that 1860?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm going to type that in. Because I think it's like 1861, but I could be
totally feel wrong. Really proud that I can even get that close to it.
American Civil War, 1861 to 1865.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah, isn't that interesting? Yeah, that's fascinating that all that's kind of in the same spot.
So it was the beginning of industrialization.
Mm-hmm.
But all these amazing writers are out there churning out this great stuff for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, and industrialization does not impress Charles Dickens, does it?
Not a lot.
I can imagine. I've read things about what London looked like. Mm-hmm. I don't know when Jack the Ripper was supposed to be floating around. I should look that up. But whenever you see a Jack the Ripper movie, it's always very dank and foggy and smog.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm guessing it's right around the same time. And it was so bad at that time in London because of all of the industry just making the natural fog worse. They said it's a pea green to a yellow. This is what London looked like for years. And that was what Charles Dickens knew as London.
And it's interesting because you bring that up and the book starts with the fog.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fog is going everywhere. And also all this mud and these flakes of soot. And, of course, the flakes of soot come back later in the book in quite an amazing way. But we won't get into that yet. But I've read that people say, yes, the fog is representative of the problems with the court system.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see anything. It penetrates everything. And I loved the way he's so good at descriptions. And of course, people who don't like his writing will say, of course, he was writing by the word. So he used a lot of them.
Yeah.
But if I could just read just a little,
go right ahead.
This is the second paragraph. It says fog everywhere. Now I can't read. Fog everywhere. Fog up the river where it flows among green eights and meadows. Fog down the river where it rolls defiled among the tiers of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes. Fog on the Kentish heights. Fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs. fog lying out into the yards and hovering in the rigging of great ships. And he goes on, and it's just the fog is mm-hmm. everywhere. He describes the entire town by how the fog lies on it.
Yeah, and you know, here at the outset, you know, you mentioned the justice system specifically, which right. is, you know, that paragraph leads right into him talking about chancery and things. Yes. But I think Dickens is talking about the entire society. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not just fog that's seeping everywhere, you know, and it's not the justice system creating this fog, although I guess that is a pretty good analogy, though, isn't it?
Well, he did say in the preface of my book, and I don't know if yours had this, this mm-hmm. this is what made me go, oh, I really may love the way he writes this, because it was so funny. He said, didn't realize that he was a law clerk, Dickens was.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew firsthand of a particular case that was just like Jarndyce and Jarndyce. And Jarndyce and Jarndyce is a law case that is going on when the book starts. It's been going on for a really long time, and it's an argument over an inheritance. But it's been going on for something like 20 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. nobody's gotten the inheritance. All these people are living with the expectation of it and hoping for it. But the lawyers are basically eating it all up.
Yeah, yeah.
And so his preface, he says, a chancery judge once had the kindness to inform me, as one of a company of some 150 men and women not laboring under any suspicions of lunacy, that the court of chancery, though the shining subject of much popular prejudice, at which point I thought the judge's eye had a cast in my direction, was almost immaculate. There had been, he admitted, a trivial blemish or so in its rate of progress, but this was exaggerated, and had been entirely owing to the parsimony of the public, which guilty public, it appeared, had been until lately bent in the most determined manner on by no means enlarging the number of chancery judges appointed.
Hmm.
He says, this seemed to me too profound a joke to be inserted in the body of this book, or I should have restored it to Conversation Kenge or to Mr. Vholes, with one or the other of whom I think it must have originated. Which
that?
Tells you what he thinks of those two.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and because then one of the notes says that there were, until very recently, something like 2 or 4 chancery judges.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why hundreds of years. And so that's why everything was so slow.
Wow.
Because it just went through those few judges.
Yeah.
And that's one reason he wrote this.
Yeah, I highlighted something that I thought was terrific. That explains this. He says, the one great principle of the English law is to make business for itself. There is no other principle distinctly, certainly, and consistently maintained throughout all its narrow turnings. Viewed by this light, it becomes a coherent scheme and not the monstrous maze the laity are apt to think it. Let them but once clearly perceive that its grand principle is to make business for itself at their expense, and surely they will cease to grumble. And, okay. You know, we're laughing, and several times in this book, I just stop and laughed out loud. Oh. I mean, it's a serious
so
book. It's a serious book. You know, at one time I thought, man, this is just turning into a farce, you know? And it turned, you know, serious. I mean, it was extremely serious, but man, there were moments of laugh out loud in it.
Well, and I think you can't have a book that's just serious,
mm-hmm.
or it's so hard to read.
Right, yeah.
And actually, I mean, that's real life is that way. Even when something is sad, things can happen that just make you sit down and laugh.
Yeah.
So, yep. Yeah, because the story of poor little Joe, the little waif, who all he had to do for, or all he could do for a living was cross this, sweep the crossings, and hope that people would give him coins. I read his story, and I got down and I thought, oh, Oliver Twist had it so easy. You know, poor
yeah,
Joe.
And, you know, and that's another statement about the state of London, too,
mm-hmm.
that you need to have someone prepare the road so someone can cross it, you know, is
yeah.
just, it had to just been filthy all the time. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, it's funny because Dickens is telling the story from two different points of view. There's an omniscient, I guess, narrator. Mm-hmm. And then there's Esther Summerson. Summerson?
Yeah. Yeah.
Summerton. Yeah, Summerson.
Yeah.
And she, of course, is just telling from her point of view, so you're not always sure if she really knows what's going on or not. And she also doesn't always tell you what she thinks. Because, for instance, after the jelly bees, after she's had a lot of contact with this one family that we will definitely have to talk about, she finally, way, way down the road, kind of says a few things of what she thinks of the mother of the family. But she really doesn't comment on them.
Yeah. So one of the first lines I remember of her, she says to the reader that she's not clever. And, you know, you immediately know, well, she probably is.
Yeah.
And she is, you know, but I think she was basically saying, I didn't get everything at this point in the story. And to me, yeah. I look like I'm not clever right now.
Well, and she's a very humble person also.
Yeah, she really is. Yeah.
She was raised, she was not adopted, but like a ward of the court, essentially, raised by a guardian, I guess, who was never very nice to her. And would always say awful things like, well, I knew your mother and, you know, it's a good thing that you're here with me because you would have been terribly off and your mother was horrible and she was glad to get rid of you and things, I think, and things, awful things like that. And so she believed her.
Yeah. Yeah. So, your mother, Esther, is your disgrace and you were hers. That's the kind of stuff that she was saying.
So you pretty much know she was born out of wedlock.
Right. Right.
That gives you that clue.
Mm-hmm.
But Esther's part of the story, I'm trying to think, there's no good way. There's several things that happen. This book has Esther's story, which tells of her finding of her actual guardian and a good friendship with a young man and a young woman who are also under the care of the same guardian, and what happens to them in connection with the Jarndyce and Jarndyce case.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, everything is connected, even though it doesn't always seem like it when it starts off.
Yeah, and that's what's remarkable, that he wrote it that way in 19 installments. And yet everything, I don't think that there's a loose end in this 700-something pager.
Uh-uh.
Writing it by hand in 19 installments and... Yeah,
it blows
me away. It blows me away.
Well, I was flipping through it at one point, and like I said, tonight, and somebody says, oh, and do you remember me, Esther? And Esther says, oh, my gosh, you're my old guardian. And she's just as disagreeable to her as she always was, the guardian. And then she goes, well, actually, my name is Mrs. Chadband. I've gotten married, or that's close to the name. Mm-hmm. And you suddenly go, oh, I've been reading about you the whole time, off and on, and now I understand your extremely unpleasant character. Yes. Okay. Yeah, it all just kind of comes together. He connects everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But Esther's story to me was interesting because it was, I guess, the most obviously about family because she doesn't know who her mother was. But partway through, the reader begins to suspect, way before Esther does, of course. And so that little mystery is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Esther's quest for happiness and love, although that's not all she's doing, but, you know, like anybody, she would like it. And the influence of Jarndyce and Jarndyce upon the character of Richard, the young man who's also under the care of the guardian, and what it does to them. So that's one kind of simpler story, I guess.
Yeah.
But touching in it is this overarching story, which the omniscient narrator tells you. And that is, it's got everything. Not only, as you said, Scott, is it so funny, but it's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the first cases I've read several people saying of an actual detective being used in a novel, Mr. Bucket, Inspector Bucket.
Yep.
And it's also, to me, kind of a horror story. The way that one guy dies.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Dickens there's a
ghostly presence too.
Yeah. Spontaneous combustion.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was a heck of a scene. These guys go in there and they're, they think that there's a burnt log in the middle of the room. And when they realize, it takes them a while to realize what it is. And when they do, they run out screaming.
Well, yeah, because what makes it nasty is it's a young man who boards above this guy and his friend, and they've been packing up to leave or something like that. And he keeps saying, where's this soot coming from? It's much heavier and oilier than most soot. And where's this stuff coming that's kind of coming out of the walls? And so you suddenly realize when they find that, you're like, oh, no, that was this fellow.
Oh, man.
But that's where it gets funny again, because later they're going back to get the young man's stuff. And I couldn't find the sentence, but it says something like, and neither of them really wanted to actually touch the things with their fingers. They were using handkerchiefs.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't want to even have it near me.
Oh, boy.
And the way he said it was so funny.
Yeah. You know, I thought the contrast between Esther's chapters and the narrator's chapters were striking. I listened to the audiobook. I kind of read and listened, you know, it kind of helped me get through it quicker. And the version I had was absolutely terrific. It's by Naxos Audiobooks, narrated by Sean Barrett and Teresa Gallagher. It's available on Audible. But I don't know if it's because I was listening to it, but it would be interesting to know if you kind of had the same feeling. But I know that my brain is trained by watching so many movies, but there were times where, you know, I'd listen to Esther, and then the next chapter would be a narrator chapter, and it's almost as if I could feel the camera just pull back, because the narrator was always talking about everything. He said, you know, London is blah, 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 and this is amazing, you know, and look at this, and look at these people over here. And then he kind of slowly zooms in on something. And it's almost every time the narrator starts up, he starts up in a similar way, where he's pulling way back and really cinematic. It felt to me, you know, really felt cinematic. Although I really don't think, and I know that there's a BBC version of Bleak House that was a miniseries. I can't imagine how you could film this. You could film the events, right? You could film the plot.
Right. Right.
But the most of this book, for me, takes place when there's nothing happening. It's the narrator speaking or Esther observing, and I don't know how you could have a good experience with this book. Although, you know, I guess the story is just fine. It's not like the story's bad or whatever. I mean, the story itself is good, but for me, everything in here was taking place during the pauses. And that was what interested me most all the time. I mean, something would happen and then the narrator would start to talk about London or the streets or this house or something like that. And you'd just look at it and, you know, I could spend the rest of the hour just reading quotes that I've highlighted.
Plus he spent a lot of time with minor characters, and he would have... you know, two husbands and wives meeting for dinner who you didn't even know why you were reading about them. Later on, they touch on the story some.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're involved. They live in the neighborhood. And part of the story is actually about solving the murder, not of the spontaneous combustion, which Dickens was taken to task for. And he stoutly defended himself by saying, look, here are all these documented cases.
Mm-hmm.
That's in one of the essays and I think part of one of the forewords where he's defending himself about that.
Saying,
but there's
hey,
a murder
there are people that spontaneously combust?
Well,
is that what
he
was doing?
Said.
Okay.
That's what he said.
All right.
I didn't, you know, really look into it, because when it happened, I just sat there and went, oh, no, he didn't do that. He went there. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's interesting that he would feel like he'd have to defend himself, because even if something like that could not happen.
Yeah.
It was a literary thing that made an incredible point.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, it's interesting that he felt like he had to say, well, that could happen.
No, he
so
was
his definitely. Novels were not fantasy. It would be interesting to read what he thought of literature and in general. He was, you know, literature is something to make points, or I remember reading some about Henry James versus H.G. Wells.
Mm-hmm.
And James, you know, wanted the reader to figure things out. And anyway, I'd have to back up and read some more of that. I haven't brushed up on that, but
I was going to say, let me guess. Yeah. Wells wanted to make sure you understood. I'm thinking of the War of the Worlds, which I love, but boy, you're hammered over the head a few times.
Right. So it'd be interesting to think, you know, it just when you said that, it pops out at me that Dickens must have felt that he had to use reality in his fiction only. But no, how could that be? Because he wrote Christmas Carol.
Unless
he felt like he had to defend ghosts. I don't know.
No. No, but I think he used whatever was at his command. And I guess in this case, he put it in because he felt like it really happened. And he had all these documentations. And again, I'm sorry I didn't look it up, but it gives everybody something to do. I'm on James's side.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting.
But but there is a murder that happens in the book. And you're pretty sure you know who it is who's murdered, but, you know, they don't even really know his name.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the book is following people as they're trying to figure out who was it who got killed, who killed them, why. I mean, I felt like that was the core of the story, don't you? What do you think?
Well, the core, I don't know, that took up about
the omniscient narrator story.
Of the omniscient narrator story. Well, I felt the thing as a whole was an illustration of how we're all interconnected, even if we think we're not.
Well, yes.
So, I mean, but I guess we could call that what I believe is the overall theme of the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't think that's what the book was about.
Right. So,
what does the back of my book say?
Yeah.
I'll just read this since we've done a terrible job of describing anything.
But I mean, the problem is, you know, like I said, describing this book by its plot misses this book, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, it says it blends together several literary genres, detective fiction, romance, melodrama, and satire. And, you know, and we've said we saw other things in there, too. So it says, opening in the swirling mists of London, the novel revolves around a court case that has dragged on for decades, the infamous Jarndyce and Jarndyce lawsuit, in which an inheritance is gradually devoured by legal costs. As Dickens takes us through the case's history, he presents a cast of characters as idiosyncratic and memorable as any he ever created, including the beautiful Lady Dedlock, who hides a shocking secret, which I won't say what it is, although they do hear, for shame, Barnes & Noble, and a long-lost love, Mr. Bucket, one of the first detectives to appear in English fiction, and the hilarious Mrs. Jellyby, whose endless philanthropy has left her utterly unconcerned about her own family. Mm-hmm. As a question of inheritance becomes a question of murder, the novel's heroine, Esther Summerson, struggles to discover the truth about her birth and her unknown mother's tragic life. Can the resilience of her love transform a bleak house? Okay, that's not really fair. That house was not that bleak. It was just named that. And more devastatingly, will justice prevail?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would have to say one of the main threads is about that murder.
Mm-hmm.
Because that pulls in Lady Dedlock. I mean, you really don't know who did it. And I have to say, I was stunned by the resolution of the murder. I thought I had this one down pat.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not. Maybe you weren't surprised, but
no,
I was.
No,
and
I then, was. So.
And then, and it's also about the Jarndyce and Jarndyce case and how it sucks in and influences everyone by giving them false expectations and that kind of thing. And in that case, Scott, that's where I think it's also a reflection of the British culture of the time. You know? Some people didn't have any expectations and some did. And the ones who didn't sit around and wait for Jarndyce and Jarndyce were the ones who were the happiest. Like Esther's guardian. And
Richard, who's one of the people that is taken care of by Mr. Jarndyce, the guardian.
That's right.
He, you know, spends a little bit of time trying to figure out what to do. And then he says, well, I'm going to go ahead and be a lawyer now. After trying to be a doctor and not being very good at it. Anyway.
And to see, I guess.
Yeah. And then he gives his whole life to it.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, he's convinced that that's going to make him rich, this case, which we never find out, you know, what is it about, really. It's just Jarndyce and Jarndyce.
Yeah, it's just some argument about the inheritance between two people.
Right. And there's no resolution. It is resolved. Yeah, it is resolved but only because they run out of funds.
They run out of money and they go, well, this estate, case is done.
This giant estate has been completely used up by court costs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, and you mentioned that Mrs. Jellyby. That was interesting because, you know, you talk about families and families in this book, and there are several of them. And, and you know, I think you can even fine-tune that just a little bit further and say it's about kids because this book is filled with suffering children.
Of different ages.
Right. So they talk about Mrs. Jellyby ignoring her family because of her philanthropy. And there's a guy named Mr. Turveydrop who made me laugh out loud several times. But his son is suffering. And the reason that he is because Mr. Turveydrop spends all his money on himself because deportment is more important than anything. How he looks and acts and his manners. And there was one part where he had a gold watch. And in fact, I've got it right here. It says, "My dear," said Mr. Turveydrop benignly to his son, "do you know the hour?" "No, father." The son had no watch. The father had a handsome gold one, which he pulled out with an air that was an example to mankind. Love that.
Well, and it's funny because Mr. Turveydrop has convinced his son that he's right. I mean, he's raised him this way, and his son is all very humbly ready to do anything to keep Mr. Turveydrop, old Mr. Turveydrop's deportment up. That's fine. And then Mr. Turveydrop is so much better than Mrs. Jellyby that when young Mr. Turveydrop marries the oldest of Mrs. Jellyby's daughters, who's been miserable living at home, she's so happy because she thinks Mr. Turveydrop is just a prince among men. And Esther goes away thinking, oh, man, well, I'm not going to say anything, and maybe they'll never figure him out. And that would really be the best. They'd all three be happy that way. And you think about it, and I thought about, you know, these days, what we would all do is pull aside that young couple and go, do you see what he's doing to you? You've got to get your rights.
Right.
And I thought, you know, maybe it's kind of a better way that it's not actively hurting them, then it's not my business. You know, they'll figure it out or they won't, but why should you say anything? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do.
And Mrs. Jellyby and Mrs. Pardiggle, I guess is how you say it. I didn't hear anything because I just read the book.
That sounds right to me.
But they, to me, were hilarious because they were offsetting characters. And Dickens does this throughout the book with all these different little groups of people who have two sets of people who are neither of whom are really great people. But they're contrasting and comparing their various flaws against each other. And these two, to me, were people that I could imagine him knowing. Mrs. Jellyby has a passion for helping the children or the poor people in Africa? And she spends all her time dictating letters and, you know, going to society meetings and doing all this. And she makes her oldest daughter take dictation for all the letters. In the meantime, there's not maybe even a whole jug in the household to hold water. The place is filthy. There's no clean plates. The little kid falls down and Esther picks him up and sits him on her lap to comfort him. And he looks at her as if he doesn't even understand what she's doing because no one's ever paid attention to him. The husband later on, Mr. Jellyby, when the oldest daughter's getting married, he comes to her and he just starts sobbing over how miserable his life is and how his children aren't being taken care of. And he's trying to earn a living, but all the money's going to Africa. And it's awful, although it's so funny.
Yeah.
It's written in such a funny way and then there's Mrs. Pardiggle, who comes visiting the Jarndyce household. So Esther meets her that way, and she's got all her kids with her. So she's not neglecting her family, but what she's doing is she's working for charity, and she despises Mrs. Jellyby, who doesn't take care of her family. Mrs. Pardiggle's family, though, she gives them their allowance, and then she very proudly talks about how all the kids, well, little so-and-so, he so happily gave up his shilling for, you know, this cause, and so-and-so gladly gave up their time to work for this cause. And Esther said, you look at the kids' faces, and they were just contorted with loathing and hatred. Of what they were talking about. And then Mrs. Pardiggle later says, well, you know, because I just love to work, love to be charitable. And when you were talking about Esther saying, I'm not very smart,
mm-hmm.
it made me think of these two ladies who like to define themselves, and also Mr. Skimpole, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who's one of the worst people you'll ever meet. Although, you know, pretty airheaded, but still awful.
Yep.
And he goes around declaring, well, I just don't understand money. I'm just a child that way. I don't know. And so he gets everyone to pay for everything because he never has any money. And Inspector Bucket tells Esther toward the end of the book when he's met Mr. Skimpole, and he says, let me just give you some advice that's going to serve you well when you're married and have your own household. If somebody goes around declaring they are very much something, you can bet they're the other way. He says, like this guy. He says he's like a child. That means he doesn't want to take responsibility, and he knows very well what he's doing.
Yeah.
And he ticks off all his various little Mr. Skimpole's various habits. And so I didn't really think about it until you said, Esther says, well, I'm not very smart. And it's when somebody says, I'm not, or I am something, they're the opposite in this book.
Yeah. Yep.
In many ways, I think.
Yeah, in many ways, yeah.
Because Mr. Vole goes around always saying, well, I'm just trying to help Richard. All I have is his best interest at heart, and what he's doing is sucking every bit of money and hope out of him, like a vampire.
Well, I have a good Mrs. Pardiggle line highlighted.
Yeah?
She was in a house of a family that was poor.
Right.
And the man has just said, you know, you can go ahead and get out of here, I think. And it says, Mrs. Pardiggle, who had been regarding him through her spectacles with a forcible composure, calculated, I could not help thinking, to increase his antagonism, pulled out a good book, as if it were a constable's staff, and took the whole family into custody. I mean into religious custody, of course. But she really did it as if she were an inexorable moral policeman, carrying them all off to a station house. Yep.
Oh, man, don't we all know people like that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And it's neat. And that's, you know, that's how the narrator would speak in this book. You know, he'd address you. And it was
cool.
So that
wasn't Esther? I thought that was when Esther went with her.
It could be Esther.
Because usually when it was in the first person, it was Esther.
Okay. I apologize. Yeah, you're probably
right. No.
But
just occasionally, I suppose, the regular narrator.
Yeah, he seemed, I remember a time or two where he addressed the reader, but you're right. It wasn't in first person. It was not in first person. Yeah.
Well, and that family that the Pardiggles and Esther and Ada go to visit are one of the pitiful families. I mean, there are people who he doesn't weave any humor about because they're just so wretched.
Yeah.
And you see this family again and again, the wife, the young woman who's been abused by the husband, she's going to lose her baby. You can tell it's sick, or maybe it's dead already and she hasn't given it up.
Yeah.
I can't remember. So he doesn't forget the poor people.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about the poor people a lot, and, there's something I highlighted pretty close to that previous one. So this is Esther speaking. I thought it very touching to see these two women, coarse and shabby and beaten, so united. To see what they could be to one another. To see how they felt for one another. How the heart of each to each was softened by the hard trials of their lives. I think the best side of such people is almost hidden from us. What the poor are to the poor is little known, excepting to themselves and God.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, and that highlights that point you're making about connection, because the point he keeps making over and over is, and I think a lot through Mr. Jarndyce, who's an extremely generous person and constantly keeps saying, don't worry about what happens with that case. It has ruined more lives than it would ever save if it was settled. Mm-hmm. And he does many, many kind things for people and never wants to hear a word of thank you. And he'll always, if he's worried about that kind of thing, he'll say, the wind is in the east, I think. I think it's an easterly wind. And you know, you better stop talking about anything that has to do with thanking him. But he helps. There's a family that where the father died, the mother died when the baby was born, and there's a little boy and a little girl, and the little girl is the oldest. She's 13. And the father has died. And the little girl, they have no way to live. And this is when you say, you know, for all the things our country is bad about, we at least have some kind of safety net for people. It may not be the best safety net, but no little 13-year-old is having to go off and be a washerwoman for an awful family, the Smallweeds.
Yeah.
Were just terrible to her, locking in her little brother and baby sister when she's gone so that they don't get out and get hurt and no one gets in and hurts them. You know, and she's having to pay rent to the landlady, who will forgive it for her and go up and check on the kids sometimes because she's essentially kindly, but she's got to make a living. And Mr. Jarndyce surprises Esther by hiring this little girl, Charlie, as a maid for her and paying for her brother and sister to go off and be taken care of by people who will raise them in a school. And, you know, and Charlie's so grateful. She's like, and we get to see each other one weekend a month. This is the greatest thing ever.
Wow. Yeah.
And I just, that really touched me.
Oh, yeah. It touched me, too.
Thinking about how many desperate people there have been in those situations.
Yeah.
And that little girl just doing the best she could, and the kids being the best they could be because they were sticking together and trying to get through it.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, but and then you've got the, you know, the other extreme. You've got the rich folks. And, again, you know, with the fog and then some of the stuff that he said, like, the sea has no appreciation of great men, but knocks them about like the small fry.
Mm-hmm.
And then, there was just a line about death. If I see it here, somebody died and he says, "Dead, your majesty, dead, my lords and gentlemen, dead, right reverends and wrong reverends of every order, dead men and women, born with heavenly compassion in your hearts and dying thus around us every day." And then there was the disease, smallpox, right?
Mm-hmm.
Touched whoever, it didn't matter, you know? So it's even though these people are in their classes, there are things and there are realities that touch everybody. And that helped me think about this whole thing of connection and how everybody's connected in this whole book.
Well, and in fact, that's Joe, who Esther is very kind to and takes care of while he's sick. That's how she catches it.
Yeah.
Because she is very kind, and so is Mr. Jarndyce. And so they have opportunities to help people as much as they can.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah. And the thing it made me think of, I mentioned this to you earlier today in an email. You know, Mr. Skimpole, after a while, you're just like, oh, would you just shut up and leave everybody alone, going on and on. But toward the end of the book, he's suddenly introducing his daughters to everybody, his grown-up daughters. And I was so stunned that this vain, shallow, selfish, grasping person had a wife and children. And that was the point when I suddenly realized pretty much you see family circumstances for everybody in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Not Mr. Tulkinghorn, not a few other people, but even Inspector Bucket talks about his wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, what she's like and how they have a great marriage and she's wonderful and everything. And he's very matter of fact, so it's nothing, you know, sappy. But there are a few happy families and many miserable families. And every single miserable family has one thing in common that I can think of. And you could prove me wrong easily because I didn't sit down and make a list. But there's a person in that family who's behaving extremely selfishly and not caring about the other people. And in the families that are happy, the people are all serving each other, you know, taking care of each other out of love. Like the Bagnets, if that's how you say their name. I loved that family that the ex-soldier George goes to see, his old ex-military buddy.
Yep.
And Mrs. Bagnet kind of runs the whole family. And I marked this. I wonder if I can find it, because a lot of these people will have little catchphrases, and you see them so often that when they say their catchphrases, you actually know what they mean. And he would talk. So his friend, Mr. Bagnet, would say, oh, here he says, He's always talking about how great his wife is, and she's a very managing wife, but in a kind but firm way, you know. The old girl, says Mr. Bagnet in reply, is a thoroughly fine woman. Consequently, she is like a thoroughly fine day, gets finer as she goes on. I never saw the old girl's equal, but I never owned to it before her. Discipline must be maintained. Now, and Mrs. Bagnet knows as well as anybody that she's the one who keeps everything going. So this is a little fiction between them, because when it tells the story of her birthday and she's sitting there and they're all like, we're going to fix you dinner, I think it is. And it's just killing her to watch how horribly they're doing everything. But she sits there and smiles and goes, oh, that's lovely. Oh, wonderful. Because they want to serve her.
Yeah, yeah.
And she serves them by letting them do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't, maybe this is predominant in all of Dickens' books, but I don't remember it being as prominent as it was in this one, where you see every kind of misery. I mean, even Lady, oh gosh, what was her name? Lady Dedlock.
Mm-hmm.
Who I will now tell her terrible secret, which is that she's Esther's mother. Mm-hmm. And she never knew Esther was even alive because her sister lied to her and told her the baby died. That sister, boy, does she have a lot to answer for.
Mm-hmm.
But she becomes so distraught eventually over her secret being known, possibly because Mr. Tulkinghorn has figured it out, that she wanders off and kills herself, basically. Or maybe just dies of exposure. I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, it's not really clear, sure. Is it? She was leaving, you know.
Yeah, she's kind of out of her head.
Yeah.
And she loved her husband so much, she didn't want to disgrace him.
Yeah.
And she had told Esther, I'd love to acknowledge you, but I couldn't do that to my husband. He's such a wonderful man. And the sad, sad thing is her husband loved her so much that even when he knew more about what she had done and that she was gone, he didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just said he had, you know, a gentle sadness and no reproach at all.
Yeah.
Let's see. And even to the point of his sinking on the ground, oblivious of his suffering, he can yet pronounce her name with something like distinctness in the midst of those intrusive sounds and in a tone of mourning and compassion rather than reproach.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And he kind of went bedridden.
Sir Leicester. Yeah, he had a stroke or something.
Right, right. Yeah, and he said, you know, tell her that she's forgiven. Come back. Yeah.
He was just waiting for them to find her and bring her back.
Yep.
And then there's families like, and they stick together, but they're horrible families. It makes me think of what it would be like if Fagin from Oliver Twist had a family, the Smallweeds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually what brought this book to mind originally, because Rose saw the BBC series that you were talking about.
Oh, and the Bleak House?
Uh-huh. And she really loved it.
Oh, did she? Well, that's good. Yeah. Maybe I should give it a try then. I just can't imagine.
Well, but she hasn't read the book, uh-huh. So I don't know. But she really loved it. And one of the things that brought it up that made me even think of looking into reading this in particular was that my mother-in-law is wheelchair-bound. Mm-hmm. And we had her over at Thanksgiving, and she'd do that thing that Mr. Smallweed would do, where he kind of slide down in the chair and kind of go sideways and bunch over.
Uh-huh.
And what Mr. Smallweed says is, shake me up, shake me up. And his daughter Judy comes and grabs him under the arms and gives him a good shake and props him back up, puts a bunch of pillows around him. Uh-huh. And so every so often he'll just shake me up. And so Rose is like, that's grandma. Oh, she's like, that old man in the wheelchair, shake me up. And we were just laughing. Even my mother-in-law, who didn't know what we were talking about, but we'd go, we're going to shake you up. And you go, okay, gently.
That's funny.
Yeah. So I was really waiting to meet this guy when I read the book, and I was surprised to find out how horrible he was, actually.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. So yeah, it may be worth watching. It's a long series, I think, isn't it?
Well, it would have to be, I would think.
Yeah, I know it's got to be like three DVDs or something like that.
Oh, my. Well, then maybe they do tell a lot of the story.
Yeah. Yep. I'm sure that they get most of that in there.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch that BBC version of Pride and Prejudice?
No. With
Jennifer Ely, I think is. Anyway, it was terrific. Well done. Yep.
I believe it.
E-H-L-E.
Yeah,
not a Jane Austen fan?
I like Jane Austen, mm-hmm. but I've read Pride and Prejudice several times, and so many people have read it and talked about it and everything. I'm kind of, I'd probably need to reread it and rediscover it,
because
I'm kind of tired of hearing about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not fair to the book, because I know I really liked it. That's why I read it several times. But what I really liked was when I discovered Northanger Abbey. Have you ever read that?
No, I sure haven't.
It's her making fun of gothic novels.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's a young girl who loves these gothic novels, and she's maybe visiting her aunt. Or yeah, I only read it once. I would like to read it again at Bath.
Mm-hmm.
And so she meets this young, handsome man. And he invites her and her friends to come visit him at his house, Northanger Abbey. And she immediately, oh, so everything that happens, she interprets it as though it were a gothic novel. And it's hilarious.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's really funny. And at the end, she's, of course, much very sorry she did that. But
yeah, it's interesting. I just looked up Pride and Prejudice was published in 1813.
And wow.
This one that we're talking about is 1853.
Yeah,
Frankenstein was 1818.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Interesting.
Another great book.
Yeah. Oh, that's a terrific.
Very different. But my gosh, how could you be married to Byron Shelley and not write a book that was really different?
Oh man.
Talk about a dysfunctional group. Oh man.
Yeah, the Inklings of that generation, huh?
Huh?
The Inklings of that generation.
Oh
but,
no.
Yeah.
Not at all. I hope.
And that they got together anyway. I guess that's
they did
similar.
Get together and influence each other. Yes, you're right there. You're right. Okay. You're right. Yeah. Well, the other thing is, oh, shoot. What, there was one other point I wanted to make. I thought it was really interesting how Richard's character was, Mr. Jarndyce says, that because he was always raised with these expectations of getting something for nothing, that's why he can't settle down to a real job.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's always been waiting for people to give him stuff.
Right, right.
And he's very pleasant, but he doesn't really know what he wants to do. He's never really thought about it. And the only thing he's really passionate about is being given this money. And of course, Ada, his, you know, who he marries. And she marries him because she's like, if I didn't, what would he do?
Yeah, yep.
I mean, she loves him, but essentially he kind of emotionally blackmails her into it. And so I just really thought it was interesting that we saw so much of his lack of character and how everybody, even gentle Ada, who loves him so much, keeps trying to direct him back into, you know what, just do something. And he'd say to Esther, well, I did it for a while, but you know, it was the same thing every day. And
yeah,
I get
that was
support.
Being a doctor. It was the same thing every day.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, that's how most of life is. Somebody said that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. She says, but isn't that most of life? And he's like, need it be? Or something like that. And that's when you're thinking, oh, this guy's never going to settle down. So behind the scenes, every so often, you know, people will try to go and talk to him and guide him and make him actually do something. But it's, I don't know. I just kind of saw a parallel with how privileged a lot of us are today, especially some of the younger people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't mean to go around sounding like doom and gloom, because I don't think that's true of everybody. But I just think when, you know, I see little 10-year-olds with iPads, which I did recently, I just keep thinking, well, maybe that doesn't have anything to do with working for what you want. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, we are living in a generation unlike any other.
That's
A time like in any other. You know, if we're suffering from something as a country, I know that there are individual exceptions, but it is from too much stuff, not enough stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. So,
and it's not the stuff that really matters.
And
I mean,
that's it. Yeah.
one of the things that this book points out, I mean, although there are those who are definitely in want and they need to get help,
right?
But there's so many of the people are focused on the wrong thing, you know,
yeah,
in this book. Yeah. And a lot of it has to do with stuff.
That's for sure. That's for sure.
I mean, that's not his main point, but.
Well, it is one of his points, though. I mean, he does talk quite a bit about how, you know, like deportment, him making fun of that guy constantly.
Yeah, Mr. Turvey.
I think that's what he's saying. He's saying this guy, you know, that's like having iPhones now or whatever it might be that's so vitally important that, you know, in this novel, that's an example of, you know, him saying, well, you know, he thinks he's better than everybody else. And he, you know, his deportment was overwhelming, you know, they'd say, and it just make me laugh out loud. And, you know, he wasn't saying deportment was a great thing to spend your life doing. I think he was saying the opposite.
Oh yes, definitely. Yeah. Because the really happy people were his son and Caddy Jellybee.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they were happy. They were married. They were, you know, having a life together. Mm-hmm. And
he was busy with his deportment.
Yeah. He was just kind of going along, accepting everybody's, you know, love or, you know, compliments for his deportment because everybody knew it was so fine. They all knew.
Yeah. And then the other big event in the book was Esther's disfigurement, because Esther got smallpox and she didn't make it through unscarred. She made it through with her face changed.
Yeah, it sounds like it was bad.
Yeah, and after that, now you're in a situation where you can see who treats her well, who still treats her well, and who does not.
Mr. Guppy.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Guppy, who had proposed marriage, took it back.
And he'd been stalking her.
I know, yeah. Yeah, he was
she couldn't
so
go
sad
anywhere.
She said no, that he would show up everywhere she was and just make her miserable.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, just by looking longingly, he wasn't like in her face all the time or anything, but still it was bad enough. He was
drama.
Stalking her. Yeah.
Drama all the time.
Right, right.
Yeah. And then, and the thing was, is the poor thing, it was, and it really was just an exaggeration of how any of us does. We look in the mirror or whatever thing we think is wrong with us, and then we think that's all anyone can see because that's what bothers us. And she's so worried that, you know, Ada won't really love her anymore or if she doesn't say that, she would never say anything mean about Ada like that. But it's that, you know, she just won't want to be around her anymore. Mr. Woodcourt, isn't that his name, who was they were having a nice little romance going. But she's like, well, I just he's coming back, but I just know it's done.
Yeah,
that's it.
Right.
I won't even talk to him about it anymore. And so it's, and of course, it doesn't matter to anyone because they don't care about that.
Yep.
They tell her at the end of the book, when it's 7 years later, and she's been married to Mr. Woodcourt, has a family and everything, and she says something about how she looks, and he's like, what are you talking about? You're beautiful. You were always beautiful.
Yep.
And
it made me cry.
It was sweet.
It was sweet. It was very, very nice.
Because the thing about Esther, and I know this sounds silly maybe, but I found Esther to be very inspirational, actually. Such as in that example that I was giving earlier of when she just went away going, well, I'm not going to say anything. Hopefully they won't notice it. It's not going to kill anyone that the Turvey drops are being put upon by the father-in-law. And such as when Mrs. Jellybee is neglecting her whole family to dictate these letters and tell everybody how important she is. And Esther is doing things like picking up the baby and holding it when it's crying, or, you know, trying to find warm water for everyone, or whatever it is that they're doing. She's thinking whatever she thinks, but she's mostly just doing little things to help.
Yeah.
And even when Caddy is talking to her and saying, you know how she is, you know what she's like, will you go with me to tell her that I'm getting married? And Mrs. Jellybee's like, well, you keep saying that. I don't know why you keep saying you're getting married. And so Esther tries a couple of gentle sentences to make her think, but it doesn't work. And that's all she does. And I think of these days how we're so ready to criticize each other out loud and to try to change the way each other's acting, when maybe it's not the wisest way for them to act, but you can't stop them anyway. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I sure do.
I'm not saying enable somebody doing something dangerous, but you know, what she did is she befriended Caddy. Caddy wanted to be her friend, the oldest Jellybee daughter. And she's like, well, okay. And Caddy said, you know, I don't know anything. I don't know how to be a wife. I don't know how to wash clothes or do anything. So Esther starts to teach her. Because she does know that stuff.
Right.
So she's very practical that way. And she does what she can to help, but she's not going to try and change Mrs. Jellybee. Who, she and Mrs. Pardiggle, would do well to not only give their charity to their own families, but to the people who need it in their society right around them. But it wouldn't make them important. You know, like little Charlie and her, that little family of kids, or, you know, those poor women who she's going to read them the Bible and, you know, threaten them with it, basically, instead of helping them.
Yep. Right. Yep. She says, I'm coming back.
Like, oh, just like, yeah,
whatever.
Not if we can help it, man. We'll lock the door if we see you coming.
Yep. There was a moment in Esther's story that really blew me away, and it was when she was sick. So she got sick with the smallpox after helping Charlie through them, right?
Yes.
And so now she's delirious with fever, and she says, dare I hint at the worst time, when strung together somewhere in great black space, there was a flaming necklace or ring or starry circle of some kind, of which I was one of the beads. And when my only prayer was to be taken off from the rest, and when it was such inexplicable agony and misery to be a part of the dreadful thing. It's that's a good paragraph right there. You know, and the book is just full of that stuff. And that's what I think you'd miss just watching the show.
Oh, definitely.
But it's remarkable. And again, you know, that says connection to me. How she feels, yes, that she's part of it. And of course, it reminds me of a rosary.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first thing that leaps to my mind. How.
Me too.
You know, she's one of the beads. And, you know, that's kind of what we all are. You know, we're one of the beads.
Yeah.
And when you look at yourself that way, I think you can act like Esther acts. And you're right. She is admirable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something she in there for us to learn. Yeah.
Yeah. She just thinks about how she can help other people. And if she's upset about something, you know, she doesn't deny the thing has happened that's upset her. But instead of fretting or worrying, she just says, well, I really can't do anything about that. I can't influence this person or that. I have done what I could. I will go on and do my job.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is that she's doing.
Right.
She runs the household for Mr. Jarndyce.
So I guess she's really not a YA character, although she starts the book young. But she'd fit in good with that discussion we had the other day.
Yeah, you're right about heroines. And she is young, though.
She I guess you're right. She is young through most of the book, actually.
Yeah,
and until at the end, she's,
she and Ada both are.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, she just, but, and I thought she was so admirable, such a great example of Christian humility and, you know, that willingness. She's smart, as we said. She observes these people and she sees what's wrong with them. She knows, because she'll say little things, and that's when I would laugh. Just some little remark she'd make in her own mind about, well, I certainly was sorry I didn't know more about Africa earlier.
And
because,
that's what made it funny, you know, when she says at the beginning, you know, almost the first thing that she says, I'm not very clever, but she is, you know, throughout the whole thing, she is.
Yeah. So her humility was, to me, something that...
You know what? That was just... just like you said, how it people are the opposite of what they say they are in this book. There's another example. She said that she's not clever, but she is.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No.
It's... You're right. It's all over this book. Now that I think about it, you know,
yeah,
it's
everywhere. I just all these, and now it makes. Now I've got. I can't reread it right now, but I'm just like, oh, I'm going to have to keep this out where I reread it.
Yeah,
I'll just spend my life rereading this book over and over.
This is definitely a desert island book.
Oh yes,
you know, one of the five that you take. I don't know how many do you get to take to desert island.
I don't know. This you just hope that little trunk. You know, floats up with a book or so. And so if you get five, I always thought it was 10, but
all right,
five,
10.
Okay.
No, I'll take 10.
Yeah. Well, wouldn't we? And this would be one because you could read it over and over. I mean, because we haven't even talked about there. I mean, like the little lady with the birds, Miss, is it Flick? Is that her name? You know, she lives in an apartment. She's got all these birds in cages, and she says she'll let them out when Jarndyce and Jarndyce is finished because she's one of the people who would get some money.
Is it Whisk? Miss Whisk?
Oh, maybe so.
I the only reason that comes to mind is because I have a thing highlighted. Miss Whisk's mission, my guardian said, was to show the world that women's mission that woman's mission was man's mission, and the only genuine mission of both man and woman was to be always moving declaratory resolutions about things in general at public meetings.
Who is this? Well, because this
that
is
might
Miss
not be
Flight.
The same one.
I found it. Miss Flight, because
Miss
he names
Flight.
People.
Oh, that's right. Okay,
F-L-I-T-E. He names people a lot of things that kind of indicate who they are or something like that. Flight, F-L-I-T-E, because when Richard dies, she lets the birds out.
One other singularity was that nobody with a mission, except Mr. Quail, whose mission, as I think I have formally said, was to be in ecstasies with everybody's mission, cared at all for anybody's mission.
What part is that
I
from?
Can't even remember for sure. It just I laughed out loud and I just highlighted
know.
It.
And
said,
well,
right.
And I rarely mark up books like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mark up theology books or nonfiction all the time, cookbooks. I rarely mark up a work of fiction, but I think the next time I read this, I'm going to have to mark some of those things so I can find them again.
Yeah, and I've got the Kindle version, which...
Oh,
helps.
Yes.
So I just got a list of what I highlighted on there.
Yeah.
And that reminds me, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there is a site called kindle.amazon.com that I recently discovered. It may have been there forever, but
I don't know.
I go to kindle.amazon.com and you log in as yourself, and every highlight that you've made in any book shows up in there. And you can say, show me all the highlights from this book.
Really?
And it'll show them all to you, yeah.
How interesting.
And not only
that,
but it's kind of a community thing that they're making. So you can see what other people have highlighted. And it's almost like a Goodreads thing. It looks like maybe what they're attempting. You can rate books and things and make your highlights public or not public. Make your notes public or not public. Yeah, it is interesting.
Because I remember I was looking at something and my husband said, oh, look, this will show you how many other people have highlighted this thing that you're looking at. And I was like, wow, that many people liked this quote. That's interesting.
Yeah, in the Kindle, you can turn on popular highlights.
Yeah.
And then while you're reading along, sometimes it'll show you, it'll have something pre-highlighted.
And I know, I find that so annoying.
Yeah,
so
it can be, but it says, you know, 1,000 people have said this is interesting. And you go,
yeah, but for what you're saying.
Must be interesting.
Yeah, but for what you're talking about, that is an interesting idea.
It's an interesting idea after you've read the book, I think.
Yes.
To be able to see kind of what other people thought and you know. I guess that's what we're all doing over on Goodreads, but to have your actual highlights show up in Goodreads, wouldn't that be cool? If they could do some cooperation instead of everybody wanting to do their own.
Well, and speaking of Goodreads and how you find things via them, I have not listened to the latest SFF audio where they talked about Tarzan of the Apes, which is a book I read when I was a teenager and still enjoy, despite all the things that are wrong with the book that was written about Africa back in that time. Let's just move on.
Yeah.
But the Tamahome... He said that he was listening to Tarzan of the Apes from a podcast called The Fantastic World of Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Yes, David Stifel.
Yeah, and so maybe I've discovered this guy and forgotten him, or you've mentioned him and I've forgotten him. But
I don't know that I've mentioned him here. I'm pretty sure I participated in a podcast where we were talking about, I think it was A Princess of Mars, the first Mars book.
Okay.
And
okay,
it would have been, yeah, it would have been almost a year ago.
Okay.
And, yeah, he's terrific. David Stifel's a very good reader.
He's terrific. Yeah. And we'll have to put a link because, or just look for it under that name, because that's what I did. And it popped right up because I started listening to Tarzan of the Apes because I'm still slaving away. I'm like Jarndyce and Jarndyce on the Worthington Direct catalog.
Your mouse is flying like the wind.
Oh, yes. It's going to look fantastic, people. The,
great.
The products are going to be glamour looking, but it's taking a long time. And so I've been listening to various pieces of audiobooks, and I've gotten hooked lately on his reading of Tarzan of the Apes. It's really good.
Oh, that's great. Yep.
And I love a little Tarzan, so.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd mention that.
That's great. That is neat. Yeah, Goodreads is a fantastic place. Both Julia and I are both on there.
Yes, so, I love it. Mm-hmm. You find so many things you would never have found from just reading the comments of people. And I wish they had that for movies. And I've seen a lot of people requesting.
I remember I wrote you and said, do they have one of these for movies? Because that would be handy. And I started looking and couldn't
find anything.
Maybe we better make one really quick.
Oh, well, you go right ahead and I'll be happy to join in.
Hurry fast. Get Rose on this.
Copious spare time.
Yeah, that would be kind of a fun thing to do, wouldn't it?
It would be really fun, wouldn't it?
Terrific. Oh, yeah, lots of fun.
Yeah, it would.
So have you managed to get out and see any films lately?
Oh, thank you for asking.
Yes.
Yes, I saw a screening last week of The Life of Pi.
All right, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's out tomorrow, I believe, right?
Yes, it is. And my big review will go up tomorrow because it was under an embargo until...
May I take my 12-year-old daughter? It's PG-13 or whatever?
You may, as long as she does not mind seeing real animals acting like real animals.
Okay, great. Yep, when she's going to love it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. As long as she's into the circle of life and she understands how that is when you see that happening right
completely.
In front of you.
You bet.
Yeah, have you read the book at all?
I have, yeah.
Okay.
Long ago. I mean, it's got to be 5-6 years ago. So I have a dim memory of it. But
okay, I'd heard of it. And I maybe even kind of got it out of the library and looked through it a little bit and then went, eh, not right now, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So all I knew was that it was about a boy who was shipwrecked. Ship's gone down. He's on a raft and there's a Bengal tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe something about God. Not sure.
Yeah.
And so I can't tell you how stunned I was to sit there in this movie, which is, you know, directed by Ang Lee, who's a very big director. And it's the kind of 3D that I understand that Avatar was. I mean, they used James Cameron's 3D company. And it isn't integral to it, but you're not going to be sorry if you see it in 3D. It wasn't dark seeming when it shouldn't have been and all that kind of thing. And they did some nice stuff with it. But I was sitting there and it's starting off with the writer sitting, talking to middle-aged Pi. And he says he was in India, but he couldn't write a book. And he meets basically Pi's uncle who says, oh, really? You should talk to my nephew in Toronto or Montreal, I think it is actually in Canada, who will tell you a story that will make you believe in God. And I sat up in the movie and Tom and I looked at each other and went, what? Ang Lee, big movie, opening on Thanksgiving, and they open with this question? And, you know, then, of course, the whole movie is basically God is not forgotten because the story's going on, but they keep coming back to what's the point of the story, how does the character feel, and the end was fascinating. I don't know what the book was like, but we left thinking, what exactly did that mean? And so it wound up being very thought-provoking. We did a lot of talking, and we decided what it meant. But, you know, it's kind of left open the way these things are.
Well, good.
I don't know how the book was. So
okay.
If it plumped
I don't. I don't remember it clearly enough to say. But I'm looking forward to it.
But
we'll see tomorrow or Friday, probably.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'd be curious to hear what you think, because it was one, obviously, that I thought we might talk about sometime.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It was an amazing book.
Yeah, we're definitely
going to check it out. So how about you?
Yeah, I got, speaking of Avatar, I managed to see those last two Shyamalan movies. Devil, which he is a producer for. Right. And then the Last Airbender.
Okay.
And the Last Airbender, I did find incredibly disappointing.
Oh.
It was really looked nice, but I'm not really sure what happened. You watch the movie and you're like, well, I don't understand why he's doing any of this stuff. And it's almost like they forgot the material that ties everything together. You know, they gave you these nuggets, but they forgot it's not peanut brittle till you bake it, I guess. You know, you've got the peanuts, cool, but you don't have the stuff that holds it all together. Because the individual scenes were, you know, fighting scenes and, you know, this martial arts thing. And it was just like they just really didn't bother to tie it together somehow. So,
there was a big script story failure.
Exactly. But, you know, the actors were fine and everything looked good. And then had the opposite feeling in the movie Devil, which I liked quite a bit. I liked more than I thought I would.
Oh, okay.
What it's about is there's a high-rise building that people get on an elevator, and it ends up, I believe it's five people. They all get in the elevator, and halfway up it stops, and lights flicker, and when lights flicker and go dark, somebody dies every time that happens. And even though they're in this little small room, nobody knows who is doing this. And
really? With just five people?
Just five people, yeah. And, so they're all accusing each other. Every face in there is threatening. And the people that are running the building, a couple of security guards can see them through a camera, and they can talk to them, but they can't hear what they're saying back. And so there's some communication back and forth, and they're constantly trying to get this elevator free. But of course the devil is involved, which makes everything difficult. And
how interesting.
And I thought it was somebody, I can't remember if it was Joseph Susanka. Somebody said, hey, it was very Catholic and you should watch it because it was very Catholic. It could have been an email we got. I wish that I knew for sure.
Rose has seen it, and I don't think she said, well, she may have said that too to me, but I know she said, you would like it, Mom. It's M. Night Shyamalan all over it.
Yeah, and it was very Catholic, in my opinion.
Okay.
I was really pleasantly surprised by it. Thought it was good. So again, he was a producer, and I think he did the story. He didn't do the script. He just said, hey, this would be a good idea.
Story.
And then they wrote the script.
Maybe that's what he should be doing now.
Yeah. Well, I'm really looking forward to his next one, which is that After Earth, I think it was called.
That was the thing. I was thinking it was something about outer space. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, with Will Smith and his son.
Oh, that's right. So, that's right. I know. I do want to see
double
that.
Good. It'll be great. He'll be back to great.
I have heard Skyfall. The Vatican's newspaper's movie critic really liked it. Now, I don't go by really what the Vatican newspaper movie critic says, y'all. I do take notice when they're going, you know, this James Bond, he shows he could have redemption. He could even shed a tear. And I'm like, what? James Bond?
James Bond? Yeah. I did see that.
I did go and see it.
Yeah, I forgot that it's been a month since we last spoke, but yeah, I went and saw that movie.
Oh, okay.
And I agree. I thought it was one of the best Bonds ever, and he was the most human portrayal of James Bond that I've seen yet.
Well, I loved him in Casino Royale, which was very much like I remember the book being. I didn't see Quantum of Solace.
I've never read any of Ian Fleming's books, but...
Well, you know, when you're a teenage girl and you're trying to find books that are interesting and have maybe a few dirty parts in them that your parents leave lying around, you go for the Ian Fleming. Excellent, but, you know, it really didn't have any dirty bits. They were all just alluded to. It was all just James Bond. So I read them. And I didn't really like him that much, but it was very interesting to have those as a basis for when I finally started watching James Bond movies. And that's why Casino Royale, a lot of the stuff that everybody complained about, I was going, no, that was really true to the book.
Yeah.
The tied to the chair thing, all that stuff. So,
yeah.
But that's interesting. So
very good. Worth watching.
Yeah, yep. Well, and I wanted
and the
to
action
see
it scenes are incredible. I mean, well, the opening sequence, you're just blows you away. I remember it was Casino Royale where they had that opening scene that was that incredible chase. That
huge chase. Yeah. And this sounds like it might be like that.
Yeah, very
too.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah. Yep,
that opening scene.
When
scene's
I heard
great.
It described, I thought that sounds very connected. Yep. So.
So that's
Skyfall.
Yeah,
I know we were hoping to go see a movie maybe this weekend.
Great.
So.
Great.
Yeah.
And maybe The Hobbit will be out soon, which is our next book.
Oh, yes, it
yeah,
is.
As everyone else in the planet is reading The Hobbit, so will we.
Yes. We're going to join those lemmings going towards Tolkien's story.
But before that, yes.
We're going to watch The Paper, directed by Ron Howard and starring Michael Keaton and Marissa Tomei and, Randy Quaid, I think. Glenn
That's
Close,
great. Yep.
Jason Robards, all
and I
these
just
people.
Put that on my
Robert
Netflix
Duvall.
Feed, and you can stream it on Netflix. Just FYI, folks.
Yeah, you may be able to get it free on Amazon Prime. I know you can get it on Amazon Prime, but you may be able to get it free.
Great.
Not sure. We showed it to so many people. We finally just bought it. So
that's awesome.
And then you. Got a movie
I picked a movie for after The Hobbit
excited.
We're going to take a little bit of a break, not too long though.
Yeah,
we'll be back something like January 10th. I don't have the calendar in front of me, but something
I was thinking
like
mid-January. Okay,
yeah, but it wasn't that long. We skipped that first the way that the weeks fall, it's not that long a break at all. Let's see. Yeah. Right, the 10th is when the podcast will publish. So, so we'll record again on Tuesday the 8th, and we'll talk about The Day the Earth Stood Still, but not the Keanu Reeves version.
I'm super excited by both those statements.
Poor Keanu Reeves, the original 1951, The Day the Earth Stood Still by Robert Wise.
Oh yeah,
that's going to be fun.
Really an amazing movie.
Yeah.
And it's funny, that's one of those movies that I watched when I was younger on, Saturday afternoon or whatever, and thought, old science fiction, who cares? And then watched it a year or two ago, maybe, with the family, and just said, oh my gosh, this movie is so great. I just didn't know enough to recognize it then.
I felt the same way. I watched it maybe 4 or 5 years ago for the first time and was just like, whoa, that's really good.
Yeah.
Surprising.
Right.
Yep.
Considering we all know the scene of the one robot standing there,
Gort.
You just have no idea that it's
Klaatu Barata Nikto.
Yeah, you just have no idea that it is what it is. So, yeah.
I have my very own Gort. I'll have to send you a picture. It's about 3 inches tall.
Oh, okay.
I really do, and it's made out of aluminum. It's neat.
Do you have it at home or is it at work?
It's at work.
Of course, that's the best place for those things.
I have a robot collection at work.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've got a Wall-E and a R2-D2.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you do at work? You know,
play with your robots, obviously. Isn't that what everybody does?
That's right. I thought that's why they hired me.
Yeah.
That was on the resume, robot collection.
Yeah. And they went, well, we've got to see this. Get this guy in a desk right now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. Well, that was fun. Yep, that was fun. Sorry if I seem a little slow today. I have a cold, but I think I made it through mostly intact.
Yeah.
My deportment was not too overwhelming.
No, felt not the need to, worship you, but I do respect you.
Oh, good.
So I feel it was just right.
All right.
Perfect balance.
Thank you.
And I hope I've learned a lot from Esther.
Oh, what a book that was. Again, thank you very much. I never never would have dreamed of reading that book.
Oh, well, I'm so glad. Yeah. And, it was one of those personal challenges of, you keep saying you're going to read another classic book. If you don't actually start one, it will never happen. Yep. And so I was so astonished that this one would capture my imagination so much that I would be reading pieces of it out loud to my poor suffering husband, and I would be laughing out loud, and I would put it down, and I'd say, you know, I know I should read that more current book, but I really got to get back to Bleak House.
Absolutely so. Right. Felt the same
way. So don't go by us, who we didn't really give a coherent anything about the book. Other than when I read the back of it. It was just us having fun talking, obviously.
Yeah, it was fun.
Get that book and read it.
For sure.
Oh, and the one other thing I'll say is that it's surprisingly modern.
Yes. That is surprising, too.
The way it drops you right into the story. And Heather Ordover mentioned that, too, because her husband started reading it, I guess, based on me going, oh, my gosh, everyone. And he was saying the same thing, and she was looking at it going, this is surprisingly modern style. It must have really hit people strikingly back then.
Wow. So, cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the last thing that I have to say is I found out when Jack the Ripper was active.
When?
1888.
Oh, much later.
In and around the Whitechapel district of London.
That I knew, although I probably couldn't have told you without prompting. Yep.
Excellent.
Yep.
All right.
Okay.
Well, have a good couple of weeks, everybody, and we'll see you next time for the paper.
Yeah, have a good Thanksgiving, and talk to you soon.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Bye.
Bye-bye.